Hey guys, thank you for coming back and watching another video. This one's all about poppers. What's the big deal?
New tonight, the FDA is warning people to stop using poppers, popular
top water pattern
found online or in stores. They cause relaxation, but the FDA says they can also lead to deadly complications.
The Secret Society of Fly Tires
is talking to
Alvin Dito
tonight, learning how the
tie a popper fly and maybe some other stuff too, you freak.
They have names like Double Scorpio,
Sneaky Pete, Dancing Frog, the Howitzer, and Pops Banger to name a few. Jesus Christ.
Once you it gets into your blood system, then it can have that relaxation effect on your brain.
I had too much. He might have had too much. Then finally, he sits back, this smile comes on his face, and he is just like,
why am I listening to this podcast?
The warning is out, but the poppers are still for sale online and in store.
Hello. Thanks for joining me for another edition of the Secret Society of Fly Tires. I've been recording and compiling episodes of this show prior to going live on the World Wide Web so that I had what I felt would be a good starting point before launch. I know this probably isn't what you were expecting when you decided to listen to a podcast about fly tying. I didn't know what to expect out of it when I started either. But here we are again, enjoying each other's company virtually. Well, maybe you are. I'm alone in my garage, pretending like I have an audience, like some sort of fly-tying Rupert Pupkin.
What?
What are you doing down there so late?
It's impossible. I'm trying to tell you that.
I act like each episode is highlighting a fly pattern, and they kind of do. If wandering off into Greek mythology and referencing multiple obviously fake sources count as highlights, then sure.
Yay! We did it!
I invite guests on as experts for each pattern, and I'm equally curious to hear if they've had any paranormal experiences as I am to hear how to tie whatever fly we're talking about. I had around 25 questions for Eric from Northwest Fly Fishing Outfitters on the episode about game changers, and I think 6 of them were about the fly pattern. One of them was about making my son a suit of game changer armor. He answered that question seriously, and if I had money to burn, I would probably attempt to make it. Maybe I should start a GoFundMe and make other people pay for my amusement. That seems like a rational use of their fundraising platform. So, keeping with the theme of barely staying on track with the fly tying subject of today's show, I want to tell you a quick story that may or may not lead back to the pattern we're going to talk about with my guest today, Alvin Dito. We're going to chat about poppers, topwater stuff that no angler can claim they get tired of throwing, whether it's for monster bass, delicious panfish, or anything else. Alvin ties up a great guide fly he calls the flip-flop popper, aka the Dito popper, and we talked about that along with a bunch of other stuff. Before we get to the interview, here's the only story I have about poppers that isn't just me telling you about me fishing for bluegill. After high school, I was lucky to have the opportunity to move to the UK and study abroad for 2 years. My family had roots in the UK, and my mom called her cousins in Birmingham to arrange a room for me, which she said was all mine for at least 6 months. My parents hoped I would find myself and felt that a little culture shock would be good for me. The only thing I had to do to keep my arrangement rent-free was stay in school, keep my grades up, and maintain a part-time job on the evenings and weekends. I was quickly enrolled into Birmingham City University and scored an easy gig as an English tutor to the very diverse student population at school. I settled into a fairly boring routine, and before too long, I hit it off with a couple other tutors working the same program as me. We had a few things in common. We all loved American baseball, fly fishing, getting drunk, and partying. Somehow, they had gotten access to a private beat on the Blythe River, and we usually ended up there after school before we had a tutor. We would always have a couple beers to relax, but this time, an Irish kid who was already pissed drunk had tagged along. As he stumbled around, following us down the beat while we fished, he kept mumbling about finding a spot to do some poppers. Poppers were not a common thing thrown around at my high school in California, so I had no idea what he was talking about, and had figured he just wanted to drink more beers or something, not huff amyl nitrates. Turns out he was drunk enough to not really understand what he wanted to do with them either, and cracked open all 3 bottles he had and chugged them down.
What's the matter? Your mama didn't teach you how to chug?
He swallowed and immediately let out a sound I had never heard before and fell in the river Blythe.
No!
We stood there and watched him float face down, drifting slowly with the current until I finally snapped to it and jumped into what was only about 2.5 feet of water. I quickly fished him out and was about to give him mouth to mouth, but one of my friends yells out for me to stop due to the popper juice all over this Irish kid's lips. Was he right? If I got too close, would I end up in the same state as this poor kid who was all popped up? I didn't want to get all popped out. What if I also got sucked into whatever drug-induced alternative dimension you go to after drinking popper juice and meet some mystic teacher that knows me from another life and I have to confront sins from a time I can't remember? I can't handle reliving every shitty thing I've done in every life I've ever lived right now. No, that's ridiculous, I said, and I told my friend he was an idiot and we needed to save this kid's life. He didn't like that I called him an idiot at all and punched me right in the ear as my lips were making contact with this Irish kid's lips and all three of us fell into the river. The next thing I knew, I woke up in a rural hospital, hungover and sandwiched in between the Irish kid and my punchy friend in one giant bed like Charlie Bucket's lazy grandparents. I woke up the other two guys, and we all agreed we had to break out of whatever type of hospital would put three grown adults in one bed. So we quickly gathered our things and broke through the nearest window and ran in different directions until we couldn't see each other anymore. Technically, we're still wanted for arrest in the greater Birmingham area and have been banned from the River Blythe for life. That story didn't happen at all, and I've never been out of the country. What did you want me to write this monologue about? If you have a better story, please repurpose it and submit it in the form of a positive review of this podcast on whatever platform you choose to listen to it on. To give you some actual history on poppers, I'll of course turn to people that actually know things, like William Tapley, who did some homework and wrote for Midcurrent. William wrote, "Bass bug fishing is the oldest method of catching fish on hook and line in North America. In 1741, when William Bartram described how Florida's Seminole Indians fooled largemouth bass, which he called trout, with a bob, it's likely he was reporting on an angling method that had been practiced for generations before the Europeans invaded the continent. Bass bugs have always been bass killers. It's doubtful if the Seminoles were much interested in the sport or artfulness. They needed fish to eat, and Everglades largemouths were their most available species. So if bob fishing hadn't been an efficient way of capturing them, however much fun they had doing it, the Seminoles undoubtedly would have developed a deadlier method. Now, he probably isn't talking about foam or balsa poppers, but the method is basically the same. If they had bright-colored foam and googly eyes in the late 1700s, I'm sure they would have used them. Poppers can be twisted up using basically garbage, so I'll bet the Seminoles that are being credited with the first documented use of topwater bass flies tried all kinds of materials in their attempts to fool fish. Jason Lucas, the former fishing editor of Sports Afield, wrote, "Bass bugging is an extremely crude form of fly fishing, if fly fishing it can be called. A child of average mentality should learn bass bugging in a few minutes. You better not be talking to me. Or you." I'm not going to get too deep into stacking deer hair on this show, as I plan to go into more detail on that and other materials in future episodes. But that is obviously a big important area of topwater bass bugs. We're going to stay in a different lane today and focus on a guide fly pattern that one of my favorite personalities in the online fly fishing world ties and fishes often, the Dido Popper. Here's my chat with Houston's own Alvin Dido.
Let's dig into it. So thank you, Alvin, for coming on the show. And
thanks for having me.
Yeah, when I was mapping things out for this podcast, I made a target list of people. And I wanted, people I wanted to interview, and you were way up towards the top. One of the main reasons I decided to give this podcast a shot was to meet all the people I've been watching online and reading about for the last decade or so. And, I really love and appreciate the different types of people in the fly tying world and all their different approaches to the hobby. And I just want to absorb as much as possible and learn about the people as much as the hobby. I'd say that most of my guests up to this point have been folks who kind of embrace the artistic side of fly tying and might even enjoy tying just as much as they do fishing. I've been excited to talk to you because from what I've learned watching your videos, you seem to be kind of the opposite. Like, not that you don't enjoy it, but it fills a different space for you, right?
Yeah, definitely. I do appreciate a very artistically tied, technical, beautiful fly. But for my day-to-day purposes, I need something just down and dirty, quick and easy to tie that actually catches fish and doesn't fall apart after, 20 fish. So that's kind of been my focus for fly tying. Cool. And the fact that I do guide full time. So I just don't have a lot of time to devote to the tying part of it. So it's just been kind of, I've moved into the, you know, area that I'm in because of, you know, my needs, you know, as a, as a full-time guide.
Cool. Yeah. I mean, you've been an influence on me as a tier and, you know, in this podcast because of your simplicity and, you know, your honest, like open approach to the whole thing. It's like, it's the same way that like punk rock was for me and giving me like the confidence to play guitar in a band, you know?
And I was a huge punk rock fan, so that might have a parallel.
There we go. I mean, is that an intentional approach or maybe it just comes naturally, like you said, right?
I think it just comes naturally, you know. I the punk rock was probably where I sort of became, where I felt like I had an identity. As a matter of fact, I just saw a picture recently of a Black Flag show.
Henry from Black Flag.
With me and Henry Rollins in the same picture.
Oh, wow.
He's on stage and I'm like falling onto the stage. That was... before that, you know, I was just a kid and I didn't really know, who I was or what I was going to be, but that whole punk rock thing made it, okay, well, I guess this is what I am and I can be whatever I want to be because, you know, punk rock says that there's no rules.
Yeah, so, man. Yeah.
Maybe my punk rock experience has definitely influenced my fly tying.
Nice. Yeah. I mean, it's an important role in growing the sport. Fly fishing and fly tying, I mean, it often seems kind of inaccessible, too tough, too expensive, snobby, whatever, you know.
Yeah.
Like how and when did you start tying flies?
Man, I started tying flies shortly after I started fly fishing, and partly because when I got my fly rod at 12, I mean, it was a miracle that my parents were able to find the fly rod in the first place, and there just weren't very many flies available out there. Maybe those little aluminum tins, you know, with the little twist top that spun around that had like a different selection of flies, but they were garbage. Mm-hmm. And I was actually fishing for bass, panfish, and occasionally even in the salt. So I needed to get some flies. And I had been a model builder as a kid. So I had balsa wood, I had X-Acto knives, sandpaper, paint. And so I just started making, and initially my flies were mostly like balsa wood creation. So like frog patterns and poppers and stuff like that. And, I just made them because that was the only way to get them, you know? And some of the stuff I made was pretty creative. You know, think about a 12-year-old kid with a hobby set, some of these frog patterns. I mean, I don't have any of them. I wish I did, but I do remember some of the stuff I made. And I was like, wow, that was pretty wild. That's and I caught fish. So, you know, I was hooked on the tying aspect of it almost as quickly as I was on the actual fly fishing part of it.
Nice. Yeah. I didn't even put those two together. I mean, I have my grandpa and my uncle both super into models and like miniatures and things like that. And I mean, my family's artistic in general, so I'm not surprised that I was drawn to tying flies and stuff, but it's an interesting correlation. You know, I've said a few times on my show that I really like tying winter steelhead flies, and I'm starting to really like tying crawdad patterns. what kind of flies do you enjoy tying? Like, when you're sitting at the
Man, I really do enjoy tying the simple stuff like a Clouser minnow, mm-hmm. you know, or my Dito popper. I guess it's just because those patterns have caught so many fish for me. So it's like, it's almost like, just making something that I know is going to work, you know? Mm-hmm. And so that's really, really cool, but I still do like to experiment and come up with new stuff. So I am maybe even more excited if I come up with something different and then I catch a fish on it. And then after that, I'm really excited to tie a bunch of those, mm-hmm. whatever that might happen to be, you know.
Totally.
I made this crab pattern that was pretty goofy looking. And I don't even know why I got the idea to make this crab pattern, other than the fact that it's a super easy to tie fly that looks kind of like a crab. And, you know, redfish ate it. And I was like, okay, well, that's cool. And it was a situation where I had tried a few flies and was not successful. And then I was like, okay, let me just throw this goofy looking thing that I made and caught some fish on it. So next thing you know, next time I'm at the bench, I'm really excited about tying that. So yeah. I guess it's, you know, because I do fish, I'm on the water so much, just patterns that catch fish for me make me excited to tie. Cause I guess in a way I'm thinking, oh, these are going to catch fish. And so it's like the process of making them is directly connected to the actual catching of the fish. Yeah. And that's pretty cool.
Just stoking you up. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Just yeah. getting all, yeah. Just get, I'm getting goosebumps thinking about it.
you mentioned crabs and, you know, I had you on my interview list, but I wasn't totally sure what to talk to you about. And in a previous episode I did on crabs with Wes McNew.
Oh yeah, my buddy Wes. Yeah, Wes is an artist and a machine. Dude, he can tie amazing flies by the thousands, you know, which is a skill I just do not have.
Yeah, you know, he mentioned that I should pick your brain about topwater poppers. And
here we are.
And so you mentioned the Dido popper, which you used to call the flip-flop popper, right?
Yep.
Can you run us through the origin of that pattern and kind of the materials that you need for it?
Okay, so that one has a great story. So I was fishing years ago out on the Llano River, which is about 2 hours from Austin. It's a pretty remote river for Central Texas. It's not really close to anything. It's a beautiful stream, just full of fish, you know, just go out there and you just catch fish after fish. And a certain time of year, it's all top water. But anyway, it was the end of a day, great day of fishing, caught a bunch of fish. I was loading the boat up and I looked down and floating in the river is like a chartreuse green flip flop. Okay. And, you know, it was trash. So I had to pick it up anyway, but I threw it in the truck and I got home and I was actually going to toss it. But I started looking at it. I was like going, man, this is the perfect color for a popper. And so I saved it and I threw it in my fly tie and stuff. And I ended up, you know, cutting it up and, you know, out of one flip flop, you can make quite a few poppers. Yeah, and, you know, started catching fish on them. A couple of my buddies started tying them. And, you know, one of my buddies actually made a jig to cut out the shape, on the flip-flops, but you know, flip-flops are kind of hard to find certain times a year, and carving the foam was the part that took the most time. So I was like, there's got to be an easier way to create this fly. And so I kind of played around with folding foam, and I ended up with the kind of final product. It was sort of a take on the crease fly, which I don't know if you've seen that one, but the crease fly is a single piece of foam that's folded over, and the hook is at the bottom. So like the hoop where you would fold it is the top, the hook's at the bottom. It's all epoxied together and it makes a pretty good splash. But I needed something that was even easier because, you know, to hold the fly together, you have to have the epoxy. And I was like, I need something that's like fast. So I ended up getting, and you can tie this fly. That's a cool thing about it. You can tie it in different sizes, different colors. But basically you need two pieces of foam and anywhere from 3 millimeter to 5 millimeter foam. And the kind of the final version, the most common size for bass and even redfish is a 3/4 inch piece of foam and a 1/2 inch piece of foam. The 3/4 inch piece of foam you fold under and the 1/2 inch piece of foam you fold over the top. So two layers, it ends up being 4 layers of foam. And really the only tying part of it is you tie the tail on. You tie the tail on, you glue your two pieces of foam on, and then you trim it, glue some eyes on it, maybe draw something on it with a magic marker, and it's done. And it's like a maybe 5 minute pattern. But the cool thing about it is it's a fly that really makes a lot of noise. So it's, you know, similar to what you would get out of throwing like one of those double barrel poppers, but okay. you can't make a double barrel popper. You have to buy the body, you know, and if the fly shop's closed, then you need flies for the next morning, you know? So, you know, once again, it's kind of like, you know, filling a need that I had. And I like to use a really buoyant material. A really absorbent material for the tail. So like a rabbit strip is what I usually use. And what I realized was by having something that wants to sink at the rear end of the fly, it makes the fly sort of ride tail down. And then when you strip it, it sort of does this kind of reverse dive where the nose has to come down. So it creates even more commotion. And with a popper, you know, the idea of a popper is to pop, to make as much noise as possible. So by having this fly where the butt's sagging down, you strip it, the nose really smashes into the water, makes a really big sound. And then the flip side of having the rabbit strip is it makes a super durable fly. I mean, rabbit strip, you know, zonker tail, whatever you want to call it, is super durable. The foam is super durable. The only thing that usually goes wrong with them is you'll lose the eyes, but I'll carry sometimes, you know, a bag of eyes and some super glue, you know, it on the boat with me so I can glue eyes on them. But I don't think the eyes even really matter that much. They do add a little bit of rattle sometimes. They do add a little bit more buoyancy, but I've caught plenty of fish on the flies with no eyes. So yeah, it's just a super durable, easy to tie, catches fish. And it's been one of my favorite patterns.
Nice, dude. Yeah, I'll link to a video of you tying that in the show notes so that people can check it out. It's hilarious to hear that this cool fly was birthed from garbage. I love it, you know. I'm not sure.
You never know. It's I guess it was like a karma thing, you know. I picked that flip-flop up to get it out of the river and it turned into something wonderful for me.
for sure, dude. Have you heard of Project Litterbug? Are you familiar?
No, I have not.
So that is actually, you can look them up on Instagram. I'll link to them in the show notes too. It's a account where this guy's tying flies out of garbage kind of specifically. So whatever he finds, he's tying up, and it's rad. I love it.
That's awesome. So Project Litterbug, that is awesome, man. So, 'cause I mean, that is one of my things, you know. We fish a lot here in Austin and on the Colorado River, and it's an urban river. And so there is a lot of trash runoff from the city. So that's been kind of one of our big missions. We hold a big trash cleanup every year on the river. So we may have to do something in conjunction with the trash cleanup, maybe like have a fly tying.
Yeah, there you go.
Like who can tie the most creative fly with trash they found out of the river or something.
Totally.
That's got some wheels rolling.
Yeah, dude. I mean, that's the nature of having a metro river. I'm in Sacramento, California. I'm not sure if you've ever been out here, but we have the American River that runs right through town. And, you know,
I've heard of it. I've never fished there. Yeah.
Yeah. It's the same problems, you know, lots of garbage. It's a bike trail that goes around the whole thing too. So like, you know, there's a lot of traffic, but, and that's awesome that you made something good out of that garbage. So I've heard, so you were talking about the sound. Do you alter poppers to produce different sounds? I mean, is that a target when you're tying these up is, you know, changing the way they sound when you're stripping them in?
Not really. I mean, I think that, you know, the basic thing with the popper is the pop, you know, so you want to just make them make as much commotion as you can. And some people have, you know, tied them like, because it's two layers of foam, you can tie the, say like the top layer of foam, so it extends over the bottom layer and it gives it a little bit more of a cavity there to make noise. Okay. And people have, tied the top layer of foam, so there's a space between the top layer and the bottom layer, so there's a little hole in between, you know, on the top of the popper. I haven't really noticed much of a difference in the sound, you know, just with different techniques like that. You know, it's mostly just, I think, that having a square surface and then having the tail, you know, dip down like that. it just, you know, it makes a lot of noise. And that's basically, if it makes a lot of noise, it's doing what it's supposed to do.
Yeah, for sure. So what are some materials that you've tried and like failed when trying to simplify or make a fly cheaper to tie?
Man, there are so many failed ones. There's probably 10 failed ones for every successful one, but yeah. And unfortunately, or fortunately, the failed ones, I don't remember. I do have a bowl full of, you know, flies that didn't make it, you know, like patterns that I tried to create and like, oh, that didn't work out at all. So I just throw them in this bowl, and the
misfit bowl.
Yeah. But you know, it's like, well, hooks aren't cheap, you know? So yeah. I keep thinking I'm going to strip the materials off and tie some flies, you know, repurpose some of these materials, but end up just sitting in the bowl forever. But occasionally I'll pull something out and like, I've got a couple of crawfish patterns, you know, crawfish are pretty complicated flies usually to tie. And I've got a couple of super simple crawfish patterns that I've tied, and I didn't like it. And then, you know, threw it in the bowl and, you know, took them out. And so far though, none of them have, you know, like, I don't have any confidence in them. So I throw them out there, fish with them for a little bit, and then take it off and go with something I know that's going to work. So, yeah, most of those misfit flies just, you know, I don't know if it's just a bad memory, but I just, you know, I just forget about them pretty quick. You know, materials wise, you know, there's a few, like I've tried really hard to repurpose like that, some of that tinsel stuff that sometimes comes in like Christmas packages or Easter baskets, mm-hmm. or something. You know, I've got a couple of bags full of this weird crinkly tinsel stuff that I know is got to be good for some type of fly, but so far I don't have a pattern that really utilizes it.
you need an Easter pattern with like the holographic Easter egg.
Yeah. There's got to be something, but you know, once again, it's like, well, I know I got like half a dozen flies that'll always catch fish, so I just kind of go back to those now. And partly because, you know, super busy, I don't have a ton of time to tie flies, and some days we go through quite a few flies. So I just notice myself, the little bit of time I do have to tie flies, I just try to crank out the ones that I know are going to get the job done. You know, I guess next time I get a little time off, I need to sit down at the bench and try to come up with, you know, the next big thing.
Yeah. So, I mean, have you ended up going through like great lengths to get creative with poppers too, though? Like if you know, start busting out like an airbrush and, you know, like, you know, and stuff like that, or?
I mean, you know, if I'm getting fancy, I'll get out maybe a black marker and a red marker and paint them up and stuff. I have a ton of respect for those. We used to sell, when I worked at the Austin Angler, there was a guy, Charlie Seipert, who came up with a couple of really innovative patterns, but he was a commercial fly tire, and he made these really amazing balsa wood poppers, you know, like bass poppers, pencil poppers, they called them, you know, because they were like that shape. And, you know, he shaped the bodies, you know, from, you know, just straight dowels, and he glued glued aluminum foil to the bodies, and then airbrushed each one of them. They were just amazing. And I remember back then, they were like, you know, like $8 or $10 a fly. Mm-hmm. And I mean, really expensive, but he was like, you have to buy 6 dozen clousers from me at this price if you want me to give you some of these $10 poppers, like to sell, you know. He goes, he's like, I won't sell you the $10 poppers unless you buy a ton of these clousers that I can tie in 2 minutes, you know? And it was, even then I was kind of like, yeah, man, those fancy flies are a lot of work.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. So I haven't ever, I mean, you know, speaking of Wes, like some of the stuff I really like, he ties like a really small game changer. And I've had a lot of luck with them, but, and I can tie flies, but I've never even attempted to tie one of those game changers because it's just too much work, man.
Dude, they're tough. Yeah. I did my third episode on game changers and yeah, they're a chore. You mentioned the Austin Angler and I've heard you mention a couple times that someone needs to do a documentary on that shop.
Go ahead. I mean, it's legendary, at least in like this part of the country. You know, it was the only fly shop for a long time. Mm-hmm. And we had just about every, you know, every manufacturer there was, and then just some of the people who work there or, you know, clients there over the years have just gone on, you know, I guess the first big thing was, you know, when they did they don't take American Express commercial and they play that during the Super Bowl in like 1987 or something. So the place had a lot of magic and, you know, probably doesn't a week go by where somebody says, oh man, you know, somebody should bring the Austin Angler back, you know?
I've always wanted to make a documentary and I'm going to go ahead and volunteer myself and my friend Morgan, who hasn't heard this idea yet for the job. can you tell us something that you wouldn't have learned anywhere else besides spending time there?
Oh man, just everything. So when I moved to Austin, I don't know, it's like 17 or 18, you know, I'd been fly fishing for a while since I was 12 years old. And I went in the shop, you know, like that was like one of the first places I went when I got to Austin. And I remember buying a bunch of deer hair bass bugs. And, you know, I was like, I'm going to go out and I'm going to catch some big bass because there's a lake, power plant lake, just, you know, close to town, easy access. I didn't have a boat back then. I just went out and waded the shoreline and I was throwing this, I think it was like a Dahlberg diver, I believe. And huge bass were coming up and just smashing this thing. And I didn't catch a single one. And I was like, oh, man, what's the deal here? And I've caught plenty of fish at that point, but for some reason, I couldn't connect. So I go back to the fly shop the next day, and I tell Joe Robinson, who's like the man. He was the guy that was in the Visa commercial. I'm like, Joe, you know, went out there, took that Dahlberg diver you sold me and just, you know, had bass blowing up left and right. I didn't hook a single one. And Joe just goes, oh yeah, I guarantee every time you got a strike, you just jerked your rod up in the air and yanked the fly right out of the fish's mouth. And I was like, yeah, I guess that's exactly what happened, you know? And so he was like, he taught me about the strip strike. He's like, you got a strip strike, keep the tip down, keep it pointed at the fly. And when the fish grabs it, just give it another good hard strip. I went back the next day and I caught several really nice bass and, you know, it was like such an elementary thing, but I had no clue. Like I said, I'd been at that point probably fishing, you know, with a fly rod for 5 or 6 years, but it was just going in there and having somebody who knew exactly what to do tell me that just one little thing, you know, it made a huge difference. So yeah. That, just one thing, you know. Yeah. I learned so much stuff just hanging out there for years before I ever started working there.
I bet. That's rad. You know, I think that kind of thing is lost a little bit these days. I mean, like speaking for myself, you know, I'm 40. I started fly fishing really heavily at like 30, right? So I've been doing it for about 10 years. And with YouTube and everything, all the resources that are available, I think it almost leads to being a little stubborn about that stuff. You think you know because you watch everything already. And you don't go into the shop and ask these people this stuff, to the experts that know, and we'll talk about the nuances with you, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it is. I mean, on the one hand, it's great because a lot of people don't have access to a person or, you know, a fly shop or whatever. But at the same time, if you do have access to an actual person, it is so much better. I mean, you know, like we were talking earlier, trying to describe tying flies in an audio format is kind of tough. You know, it could work, but even watching somebody tie a fly is going to be a little bit easier to pick up and sitting next to somebody and actually, you know, watching them tie the fly, even as opposed to watching it on the internet, mm-hmm. is going to be even better. So, you know, I'm a fishing guide, and you know, I go and people come fish with me, and, you know, just being on the boat and just the smallest little thing sometimes, you know, something that I don't even think about, you know, like the old, you get snagged on something and you throw a roll cast over the log so that your fly, so that your line pulls a fly from the opposite direction. Mm. That's something you can kind of describe, but when you see somebody do it and it works, I had so many people go, "Oh my God, that's like a magic trick." You know?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. And it's just a simple little thing, but you know, being there and watching it happen is, it's pretty amazing. It makes me chuckle every time somebody does it for the first time and it works and they're just like, whoa.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I mean, YouTube is great, especially with tying. I mean, like I talked to, you know, a few past guests about starting early enough to where the, you know, there wasn't YouTube to lean on. You had to find somebody or a book or something like that. And now you can find anybody tying anything if you're looking for it. It's all there. And step by step. Yeah. So, you know, the deeper I get into fly fishing and tying, it seems like I'm meeting more musicians into the hobby. I'm not sure why that surprises me, because maybe because most of the musicians I know would rather be making music and fish than fishing and tying flies. you know, I know you spent a good chunk of your younger adult life in bands. Do you think there's something unique that draws people to both of those activities?
You know, I think it's just the you know, on the one hand, kind of the artistry of it, but also the fact that it's like a technique that you can really spend a lot of time honing your craft, you know, both fly fishing, casting, tying, you know, it's one of those things you just kind of never completely master it. And I think a lot of people who are drawn to, you know, musical instruments or you know, even other artistic endeavors are probably drawn to the fly fishing for that same reason. It's just an endless learning process. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just, I had one of my buddies who's, up in Seattle, guitar player, singer, songwriter, Ian Moore. He, you know, we've been buddies for, geez, you know, 30 years maybe. And, you know, he's always been a fly fisherman. He's always been a guitar player, you know, he's gone from like, you know, playing small clubs to riding around in a tour bus to back to playing in small clubs to mm-hmm. touring in a Sprinter van and making all of his own music at his house and everything. And he's always been fly fishing. And I even remember when he was like, you know, what some people would say, kind of like at the height of his career, young dude with long hair riding around in a tour bus. He had his fly tying vice on the bus with him.
Oh, man. You know? Hell yeah.
You know, so it's just, I think it's just kind of that, you know, the fact that it's an art and you can always get better and you can basically can never completely master it. So that's just, I think, an attraction for a lot of people.
Totally. I mean, I'm drawn to those kind of humbling things, you know, whether it's music, baseball, poker, you know, fly fishing, fly tying, things that you think you could be really good at and can be really good at one day. And then the next day you're horrible you know what I mean? Like I like
there's
those
always things. Something else to learn, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, but I think that's a great thing. I mean, for me doing the YouTube thing is kind of like that. Cause everything I know, I've either taught myself or I learned watching somebody else do it on YouTube. And it's mm-hmm. like an endless thing. You know, you can always tweak this or tweak that, you know, and you get some pretty good results. And then you're like going, oh man, that's terrible. You know? So I think it's just maybe it's like a certain, you know, mentality that attracts you to these types of things.
There's reward in those challenging things, right? And especially when art comes into play too, because you get so tied into it, you know, like pun intended, you know, like you get so attached to your music, you know, like, and then so when you win that challenge or whatever, like it means even more. You mentioned Ian bringing a vice on the bus. Like when you were in your touring days, did you bring a rod with you or anything and take advantage of all the water you're passing through or what?
It depended on where we were going. Fortunately, the way it worked in our band, for the most part, we would go on tour, you know, and it would be like, okay, we're going to go on tour for 2 weeks, you know, 6 months from now. And so we'd go, and if we were going somewhere where I knew there was going to be some fishing nearby, I would definitely bring my gear. But more often than not, we played kind of regionally, you know, around mm-hmm. Texas. There's tons of venues you could play in Texas. So, and we got to the point to where we made enough money where we pretty much only played on the weekends. So, you know,
sweet,
maybe Thursday, Friday, Saturday. So I had the rest of the week off to go fish, and you know, we'd usually practice 1, maybe 2 days a week. And a lot of times I could skip out of practice and just, you know, drive to New Mexico and go fishing for the week. So I wasn't too worried about missing out on fishing when we were on tour, just because we weren't like a, you know, nonstop touring, you know, 9 months out of the year type of band. Pretty much everybody had families, you know, some people still had real jobs, and I had a lot of time to go fishing, hang out at the fly shop, you know, it was great. It was, you know, I was a 20 something year old guy, no responsibilities, got paid to play music got to fish in my free time.
Man, that's awesome. Yeah. I mean, I kick myself because, I mean, we did, you know, I played in a lot of bands too. And I feel like I was passing over awesome water driving across the country. I never brought anything with me. But on the other hand, we were so busy too, you know, like, and we were all working, and we'd do things like, you know, I'm in Sacramento in Northern California, and we'd drive to the Troubadour in Hollywood, play a show, drive all the way back the same night, and then go to work the next morning kind of thing. You know what I mean?
We did that too. We'd, you know, drive to Dallas and back and go to work, you know, especially in the beginning, you know, we weren't making any money. So it was just like, oh yeah, I got to go to work tomorrow. Yeah. I got bills to pay.
For sure.
Although that was a different time, you know, Austin was a much cheaper place to live back then. And, you know, that was when the whole slacker thing got started. You know, you could work, you know, a few days a week and pay all your rent and bills, and then create your masterpiece the rest of the time, whether it was music, a painting, or whatever, movies.
So if for people coming out to Texas, then, like, what are three patterns people would need to have in their box, you know, fishing out in Texas somewhere?
So I would say, and this will probably cover you for like 95% of the water, whether it's fresh water or salt water, a clouser, a woolly booger, and one of my poppers or any other popper, because depending on time of year, you can catch bass on the poppers, you can catch redfish on the poppers, you can catch all the other sunfish and stuff that are in our freshwater.
Everything eats clouser too.
Yeah. So clouser, popper, and a bugger, you know. Now you know you'd want to have different colors and different sizes, but that's three patterns that I think would get it done anywhere in Texas, you know, one of those three.
Maybe one of Wes's crabs.
Yeah. I mean, there's a bunch of other ones that would work that I would want to have, but if I could only have three, those would be the three.
So we talked a lot about kind of trying to keep things cheap and economical tying. What are some tools that you think fly tiers should not skimp on when getting set up, if, you know, they're either upgrading or buying gear for the first time?
I can think of two things. And just because I have a bunch of fly tying stuff, but I have two things that were at the time really expensive, but have stood the test of time. So I would say the vise and your scissors. My vise is 20 years old. Mm-hmm. Yeah, 20 years old. And it still works like the day I got it.
Awesome.
I don't know how much it costs. It's an old Able vise. They don't make them anymore. They pop up on eBay every once in a while. People always ask me about it in the videos, like, what vise is that? But yeah, I got it 20 years ago. And so that was money well spent. And the scissors, like, I have no idea what brand these scissors are, but I got the scissors 20 years ago.
Oh,
and
wow.
they're still, I've never even sharpened them.
Whoa, man.
Now I am careful. You know, if I'm cutting some heavy material, I use, you know, my cheapo scissors. But yeah, I've been using those same scissors, and then, you know, good bobbins. You know, I've actually got several 20-year-old bobbins, you know, but I don't know. They're probably not that expensive, or I guess they can be, but definitely the vise and the scissors. I mean, I've definitely got my money's worth out of those. And I know I've actually had a couple of other inexpensive vises. I'm looking at a couple right here that still probably work, but they're just, I don't enjoy tying on them. And so, you know, it was basically a waste of money. I should have just got the nice one and just stuck with it.
Yeah. I mean, well, if anybody's listening is like me, they're stubborn and they've probably spent money on things they thought they needed, you know, maybe spent more money on things that they didn't need to spend as much on, whether it's fly fishing or fly tying, you know, like, it's good to know those kind of things. And yeah, I totally agree. On the other side, like, what are some tools or materials that you think you can totally stay cheap on? Like, what are some things that you don't need to spend top?
I've got I'll say this because, like, I've got a couple of really cheap 20-year-old whip finishers that still work fine, yeah. Because I didn't at the time, I remember just like, oh, it's a whip finisher, right? It doesn't really matter how much that costs. I'm looking at my fly tie and stuff over there, trying to see what else do I have over there that's cheap. That's probably the only thing that I have that's really cheap. I mean, you know, some clippers, like clippers, like toenail clipper type things for cutting, I use a lot of bead chain. So to cut bead chain, I just got a cheapo pair of toenail clippers and those things, they've been cutting bead chain for years, you know? So, that's definitely something I wouldn't, you know, I don't know what else. Well, yeah, I do know. I remember, a buddy of mine had some really fancy, you know, pliers for cutting bead chain. They were like, you know, $40 pair of pliers that he cut bead chain with. And I was like, yeah, doesn't cut bead chain any better than this $2 pair of toenail clippers.
Dude, I'm sure there's some expensive pliers out there that are worth it, but I've made that mistake and bought expensive ass pliers that were like no better than anything I would get at Ace down the street, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So that's, you know, so like stuff for like smashing barbs, you know, clipping bead chain. Yeah. I do like good pliers for, you know, for fishing, for on the boat. You know, you definitely want something that's not going to rust out. Mm-hmm. But you know, if they're sitting on the vise on the bench, man, they're not, you know, it's a pretty cushy lifestyle for a pair of pliers. They're never going to break and they're never going to rust.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I feel like it's one of those kind of rabbit holes where there's a special tool for everything. There's a material for everything. And, you know, like you could buy some fancy dubbing spinner, you know, that looks like a skull or something, you know, like and spend $50 on it or something. You know what I mean? But yeah, hearing both sides of those things, you know, I have to agree with you. And I like,
he's talking about new stuff. One thing that's new that I have gotten into is the UV cure glues.
Oh, cool.
like the you know, the head cement, and I still have like the regular old head cement, but I really do like the UV cure stuff. So I do have a whole UV kit with the flashlight and everything, although I have the little flashlight. I don't have the big Magnum one, but that's been pretty cool. That is something, a new thing. I'm just looking over at my fly tying stuff to see what's new. And I think that's like the only thing that's new, you know, like I'll run out of thread and buy new spools of thread, and I'll run out of, you know, regular head cement, you know, super glue, but really that, the UV cure, glue, head cement and stuff is about the only thing that's like a recent thing. Cool. That's a new invention.
Man, you're giving me ideas, because I think, so once I start merchandising this show, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to make a UV light that is as big as like the cop mag. I'm going to make it like eight.
You just turn it on and the glue starts sizzling.
Yeah, like eight D batteries, you know?
Yeah.
So
what you really need to do is make like One that is, remember those old headlamps that had the big old external batteries?
Oh, yeah, like for raccoon hunting and stuff?
Yeah. So you make one of those with the UV light on it, and then you have to have a separate remote control. So then all you have to do is look at your fly, hit your remote control, boom, the light blasts it, and it's good. Yeah. And that could be way more expensive than a 5D cell battery because you got like a whole kit there.
Yeah, there we go.
You patent that, you'll owe me a royalty.
Well, I'll cut you in on the profit.
Yeah.
I don't have a whole lot else for you, Alvin, but I do like ending my interviews asking folks, like, you travel a lot. I see you all over the place, all over the world. Do you have any like weird paranormal stories or experiences from, you know, from your life that you'd like to share?
Well, that's it. That's a man.
I know it's not related, you know, to time flies at all, you know.
I've had a few weird experiences. Nothing recently, man. Oh God. If I had a while to think about it, I could probably come up with something. I have at different points in my life been on journeys to find paranormal experiences.
Oh man, you've been
some type of substance to help, create the experience.
Sure.
But it's probably been 30 years since I've done anything like that. But, I can't really think of anything. I'm feeling like I'm missing out here.
It's all good.
I'm coming up short.
It's nice to hear that in your younger days, you were an amateur ghost hunter though.
I definitely was. I was looking for ghosts, spirits, whatever. I found a few and I left them where they were.
as it should be. Well, you know, thanks again for spending some time with me. I know you're a busy guy, and I told you I wasn't sure what I wanted to interview about, and it's mainly because I've already learned a lot from you by watching all your videos online, and you tend to pop up everywhere, whether I'm looking for fishing videos, gear videos, hunting, and the timing's always kind of right. As soon as I was getting started tying flies, there you were, and as soon as I dipped my toes into hunting, there you are on Meat Eater. Above all, I know that I wanted to have your laugh on my show no matter what the topic was. Your energy and your positivity is infectious, and it's been a pleasure, dude. My family has some roots in Houston, and if we end up out that way anytime soon, I'm gonna bug you to let me buy you a beer.
Yeah, man, definitely. We can go fishing
for sure.
I need to get up in that part of the world and do some fishing, so I will definitely keep in touch. And I'm all about laughing, having a good time.
If you're up if you're in Northern California, let me know, dude.
At some point, I definitely will be.
Thanks, dude. Best of luck to you and your family this year. Thanks again, man.
Thanks again to Alvin Dito for coming on the program. That interview was a real treat, and I hope to speak with him again on a different topic one of these days. You probably already know where to find him online, but I'll make sure to include links to all of his stuff in the show notes. Take a lesson from the origin story of the Dito Popper and pack out some trash with you on your way back to the car after fishing. You never know what kind of karmic retribution is waiting for you on the other side of a good deed like that. You might turn some jerk's garbage into a fly pattern that slays bass all over the great state of Texas. And that part shouldn't really matter anyway. The fish will respect us more if we help keep their home clean, and they don't have the hands to do it themselves. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for another episode of the Secret Society of Fly Tires in a couple weeks. In the next few episodes, I'm going to change things up a bit. I'll be focusing on a few different rivers instead of highlighting fly patterns with my guests. And I've lined up a couple really cool people to talk to. I appreciate you joining me as this show evolves. Now, just as I've been doing with the previous episodes, I'll end the show with some information on organizations I hope you're already familiar with. Cast Hope is a nonprofit organization positively impacting kids and their mentors in California and Western Nevada through free fly fishing and outdoor experiences. Through their program, clients build mentoring relationships, fly fishing skills, outdoor knowledge, sustainable practices, and personal values. Cast Hope's gift of the outdoors empowers each mentoring pair to grow closer as they participate in healthy hobbies together. Check them out at casthope.org and whichever social network you like to use. Wild Steelheaders United
was established to educate and mobilize the numerous wild steelhead advocates. It's a place where anglers can become more informed about wild steelhead biology and ecology, keep abreast of policy issues, and learn about Trout Unlimited's conservation work. As demonstrated by history, it is certainly possible to rally conservation-minded steelhead anglers to weigh in on specific management decisions that threaten to eliminate something they value. But there is no precedent for advancing a proactive, sustainable policy agenda at scale through purely volunteer efforts. Chances of conservation success are greatest if we have the backing of as many individuals as possible across all Pacific states. This is why Wild Steelheaders United is critical. Visit wildsteelheaders.org for more info.
This episode of the Secret Society of Fly Tires is brought to you by the Northern California Crocodile Reintroduction Commission. The Northern California Crocodile Reintroduction Commission is a nonprofit organization that is working to reintroduce the once native Pacific crocodile into the Lower American River in the Sacramento region. Once the crocodiles are dumped back into the waterways, the Northern California Crocodile Reintroduction Commission plans to turn the entire river system into an extremely hospitable and erotic place for these crocs so that they may mate and procreate, so that we'll be able to enjoy these crocodiles and their nutritious meat for generation after generation. So please, go to www.fillmyriverwithbigwetlizards.org and give generously to this fine organization doing the Lord's work.
Please note that this is not a real advertisement, and the company, brand, entity, or product mentioned in the preceding ad in no way endorses, agrees with, or knows about this podcast.